All right, we're going to do a little reading and then a two-minute meditation and then the prayer. So this one's called Affirmation. Stand at the precipice, that is existential darkness, and call into the void. It will surely answer. The precipice represents our dilemma as human beings, the sense that this existence is all too random, all too absurd. Is there order? Is there a force directing things? These are the important issues, so important that we cannot rely on Scripture, but must instead explore on our own. The followers of the path compare the void to a valley. The valley is void, yet it is productive and positive. The emptiness of the valley permits water to accumulate for plants. It allows life-giving sunlight to flood the surface. Its openness gives comfort to people and animals alike. The void should not be frightening. Rather, it contains all possibilities. Peer into it. Call out. Not just with your voice, but with your whole being. If your cry is deep and sincere, an echo is sure to return. This is the affirmation of our existence, the affirmation that we are on the right path. With that encouragement, we can continue our lives and our explorations. Then the void is not frightening, but a constant companion. Meditation. Prayer. Please lay aside everything I think I know about this weekend, the big book, alcoholism, addiction, the 12 steps, myself, and especially you, God, so I may have an open mind and a new experience. Help me see the truth. Amen. So we were talking about the fact that the darkness actually creates our strength a little bit. And that reading that I did before, it's all part of the whole thing, right? The valleys and the peaks, they're all the same stuff. All those troubles and struggles that we went through are all part of the whole thing. They were all necessary for the entire existence to be what it is. I suspect we'll spend some more time with it when we get later on into the book. But you know, all those terrible, horrific things that I felt all that shame and guilt and remorse over are the things that today make me incredibly more powerful and useful with being of service to other people. Because if I sit up here and try to tell you how you're going to have some people in your life in recovery that will die, and you will gain from that experience, but I don't have that experience, then it's just my opinion. But when I can actually say that you will encounter maybe multiple sponsees as I have who have died from this disease, and gained a different experience out of each one of those, knowing that I had nothing to do with it and couldn't control it. But now when a fellow member calls me and says, hey, one of the guys that I used to sponsor is dead now, I'm of use to that person because I have experience with it. I can explain to him what I was feeling, what I was going through. And so that also, it's why the 12th step again is so important, is because it allows you to take those things, those horrific things that you felt that shame and guilt and remorse over, and use it to save somebody else from the depths of the experience that they're in the middle of. So it all goes back to the 12th step, guys. Everything that we do feeds back in. Now we're going to get into Bill's story. Bill's story starts on page one of our book. It used to, Doctor's Opinion used to be page one. When they came out with the second edition, they moved the Doctor's Opinion into the Roman numerals, which I think sucks because I know that alcoholics and addicts never read anything before page one. And so a lot of people, they don't read the Doctor's Opinion. They don't know it exists. They don't understand that used to be like a vital part of the beginning of the book. I don't like that they changed it, but it's not up to me. So Bill's story is kind of broken into two parts, okay? Pages 1 through 8 is his, 1 through 9 somewhere in there, is his experience, his drunkalogue, his war story, like his diving further down. And from pages 9 through 16, it's kind of what he encountered after he started to experience the power of God in his life, okay? So, again, we've got to read this book as if it can apply to our life. And if I read this as a stockbroker that was drinking back in 1934 and before, I'm probably not going to hook up with it. But if I change it so that it's part of my experience, and I look at how did I show up this way, then it becomes alive. It becomes alive a little bit. I just have trouble. What are we hitting here?
Liquor.
Go ahead. You hit it.
So, Bill eloquently describes his progression to losing power, choice, and control. Wonderful questions to ask yourself as you go through Bill's story. As Bill's describing his progression, did you ever think like Bill? And then Bill talks about his feelings, and you ask yourself, did I ever feel like Bill? And then when he's talking about his drinking, ask yourself, did I ever drink like that? And if you don't have drinking in your experience, ask yourself, did I ever use drugs? And which drugs did I use the same way Bill is drinking? And you start to find yourself in these pages. The big book starts to come alive. And then you get to page 5. Okay, let's talk about page 5. First full paragraph. The social use of cocaine and whiskey ceased to be a luxury for me. It became a necessity. Okay? 2 slabs a day, 2 bottles a day, Crown Royal and Jim Beam, much more became routine. Sometimes a small deal would net a few $100s and I would pay Peter because I'd robbed Peter to pay Paul before, so I would go pay off enough people where I was still getting stuff on the front. This went on endlessly. And I began to stay up all night, and I was psychotic at times. I was hearing voices, and the shadow people were showing up much quicker than they used to. You know, a tumbler full of Jim Beam, followed by a half dozen Valium, would be required if I was going to get through that day. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation. There were periods of sobriety which I believe qualified me to use drugs recreationally once again.
How many people in this room, you don't have to raise your hands because I don't mean to embarrass you. How many people in this room, in their minds, in their hearts, they still got a plan? They when I get out of wherever I am, I'm going to do this and this is going to work. Got news for you.
This is, can I describe the plan? Yeah. The plan looks like this. I'm going to get a job here. I'm going to hang out with these people. This is where I'm going to live.
You're going to stick with the winners.
Yeah, I'm going to stick with the winners, and that's it. I'm good to go. I'll go back to my sober living if I need to help some people. That's how I'll do it. I'll go to church on Sundays. I'll go to a couple of meetings a week, and that's my plan.
That is exactly what this line, I still thought I could control the situation, sounds like. Okay? When you got a plan, you still think you can control the situation. Good. Let us know how that works for you.
See, surrender is when you're stripped of all your plans. You reach a place where you've got no plans and designs, you have no idea where to go, and that's when it's really easy for you to follow the directions of a sponsor. People that don't follow the directions of a sponsor, they have a plan. Their sponsor's plan evidently doesn't line up with their plan.
I'm going to get this job. I'm going to do this. I'm going to go to these meetings, although you tell me I should go to those meetings. I'm going to call these people. I'm going to do this. Yeah, I know you wanted me to do that homework, but I had to do this stuff instead. Yeah.
Okay. I got to tell this story. So I'm taking a guy through the steps, right? And he calls me about this job prospect. And I had two other sponsees that happened to come to the same conclusion that he needed to work at this place. And I told him, I specifically said to him, this is a bad decision. It's not going to be sustainable. You're going to come out with resentments. And he had different plans and designs. And then he calls me like 4 weeks later to bitch about it. And I was like, you don't get to bitch about this. I don't want to hear about it. I gave you a clear-cut suggestion, and you decided not to follow it, so you have forfeited your right to bitch about this situation to me.
Or the guy that calls four or five people and says, hey, I really want to – I told this girl that I was going to call her. I really want to call her. But everybody that he calls says it's a bad idea. You need to not call her, and then he calls her anyways. That is somebody trying to control a situation. So I was on the wrong page. All right, so paragraph four, right? So after that morning where I woke up on my parents' back patio after wanting to shoot myself in the face, I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had said in my mind, because I hadn't written anything out, that I was stopped, but this time I meant business. I mean, I really did. Like that morning when I woke up on my parents' back patio after living through the night, I was like, man, I am not going to do this again. But as you know, 4 days later, what was I doing? That's how you got to read this story. Put your experience in this story. Yeah, so I'm gonna use a lot of the guys that I sponsor as an experience, because I'll sit down with a guy and we'll be going through their experience, and I'll say, okay, you know, we'll be talking about loss of control. Okay, so tell me what it was like after you took the first drink. All right, well, back in college when I would take that drink, I could have a couple and then we would hang out and it would be social. No, 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 okay. Tell me what it was like at the end when you took that first drink. well, back in college when I would get, and they always want to go back to this experience of when they had perceived control. They never want to look at their experience in those last days, right? When they had no power, choice, and control. They always want to recall this. Well, in high school, we would go and get a six-pack, and the four of us would drink that six-pack. Okay, that was high school. So at the end, when you bought a case of beer, how many did you drink? Well, back in high school, we had a six-pack. And they never want to look at their experience at the end. They just don't. Because, well, then you might have to admit that you might have a problem, right? So, again, you have to place your experience in this.
You know, Bill's experience through this chapter, you know, he talks about all the opportunities he had to rebuild his life, and then they all get stripped from him because he goes on that prodigious bender at exactly the wrong time. He talks about he gets tight at exactly the wrong time. We get high at exactly the wrong time. So you begin to look through your experience, and you start to look for all the lost opportunities you've had as a result of your addiction. That's one way to go through this chapter. Then he goes into the dark place where it took him, where it no longer was a luxury. Now it became a necessity because we've been doing it for so long. We have no other coping mechanisms, right? We have to have an anesthetic. Existence does not work for us. Life does not work for us. We cannot exist without an anesthetic. And that's what kept me in constant relapse for all those years. So, you know, I'd go to a bunch of meetings, and I would do the deal. I would go to the gym, and I'd get a job. And
read inspiration.
Go to IOP and learn about HALT and learn about my triggers. And I get this relapse prevention kit. Right? They gave me this little. We had a relapse prevention binder at the treatment centers I went to, and like, this is what you need to do to stay clean and sober. And that shit would fail. It wasn't until a man sat me down and took me through this book line by line where I realized everything I'd learned in treatment was horseshit, right? $250,000. That's what my family spent trying to get me clean. Now, that's a combination of treatment centers and attorneys and paying off my debt.
A lot of meetings you can get this book. Yeah.
So in essence, I paid $250,000 for this book.
I get a new book every year, and it costs me somewhere between $10 and $12. Just letting you know. So, page 6, first full paragraph. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. God, what does that sound like? That sounds like the morning after the incident when my wife announced to her family and to me all at the same time that she no longer wanted to be married to me. And waking up that next morning and just going out onto the front porch and my mother-in-law sitting out there and her asking me, you know, Sarah's got some of her own stuff that she's got to figure out, but you got to quit drinking. You think you can quit drinking for the rest of your life? And I wanted to argue with her, right? I did a little bit. I said, well, yeah, except for weddings and funerals. But then there was the other list. The list that I really drank for, right? Lighting the grill, football games, days at the beach, golf cart rides, playing golf, sunny days, rainy days, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, whatever they are, there was that list. But when she suggested to me this idea that I couldn't drink for the rest of my life, not one day at a time, she said, you think you can not drink for the rest of your life? There was no fight. There was no negotiating. There was no, well, I need to go get a job first. there was no plan. It was just like, I don't care. I don't care. But I did have the plan. I was going to just bury myself in work, but the universe took care of that one too. So, but that is, that's the remorse, the horror, and the hopelessness of the next morning. It literally was the morning for me, and it was this, the courage to do battle, the resistance to some other way than my own was not there.
Can I say something? Mm-hmm. You know, when it says this woke up, this had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink of whiskey or one hit of crack cocaine. You have to scan your experience. I mean, if you guys dig really deep, you're going to find that there you had those moments of clarity where, like, this has to be stopped. I can't keep doing this. I had those, man, over and over. This is where, you know where I find my alcoholism? It took me a while to find it. The physical part, I saw, I mean, 17 years of drinking, man, I overshot the mark on a regular basis. Right, my intent was not to get piss-ass drunk. I'd show up to a house party or a bar, and my intent was just to have a few drinks. I couldn't. So I see the physical. But in 2004, I connected some dots. I said, you know what? When I get drunk, I end up smoking crack. I end up disappearing for 3 or 4 days. I end up in a crack house. I end up in a hotel with people I don't want to be with. There's something. Maybe I should stop drinking. And I tried to stop drinking. And what I found is the alcohol still treated my restlessness and my irritability and my discontent. It was still working close up to the very end. But the deal was, if I could have stopped between the second and fifth drink, or I could stop after the first blast off the crack stem, I'd still be out there doing it. But I activate that abnormal physical reaction, and that's where I see my alcoholism. Now, when Brandon talks about horror, he gave you the alcoholic version. I'm going to give you the tweaker version. So I've been up a few days smoking crack. I think people are coming into my house. I'm hearing voices. And we had this box down in the unfinished part of the basement. It was a big refrigerator box. And I was losing my mind. I was in psychosis. And whenever I read this paragraph, what I experienced after this experience ended was utter horror, remorse, and hopelessness. And it was unforgettable because what I did was take my crack, take my cell phone, take my stem, take my lighters, and I crawled into this refrigerator box and I smoked crack. And I sat in the refrigerator box, sweating profusely, but I was so convinced that people were coming to get me that I stayed in the refrigerator box. All right. So every
such a good visual, isn't it?
Every time I
did you have really, clothes on, or were you like in your underwear?
No,
or something?
Underwear was usually in the bathroom. I'd be butt ass naked. No, you guys don't need to see that image, but that's where crack cocaine took me. And every time I read this paragraph, that's one of the stories I keep in my catalog. If you're a sponsor, or if you have a desire to be a sponsor, you got to have a catalog of stories. This is where the war stories are effective. Not when you're speaking or sharing in a meeting. And speaking from the podium, I mean, maybe one just to build some identification, but you got to have a catalog of war stories when you're trying to win the confidence of another addict or alcoholic, man. You got to show them you get it. I've been where you've been, and I haven't been there in a long time. Is that intriguing to you? So, again, fascinating.
I love the refrigerator box. So, what do we hit on? I know it's this paragraph, but what? I'll hit it, and then you can.
Okay.
So I want to point out, if we flip back, you don't have to flip back to it, but in the middle of page 4, it talks about the papers reported men jumping to the death from the towers of high finance. That disgusted me. I would not jump, right? So that's Bill on page 4. Bill on page 6. Towards the end of that first full paragraph, he says, should I kill myself? No, not now. Okay? The next paragraph, so it took 2 pages to go from being disgusted with people that wanted to kill themselves to considering the idea. One paragraph later, it says, again, I swayed dizzily before an open window or the medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself a weakling, right? Like, now he was thinking about it, but he was kind of in that place where I was that one evening at my house where I couldn't figure out why I couldn't just go ahead and off myself, right? Then at the top of page 7, he talks about people fearing for his sanity. And then we'll touch at the bottom of page 7, kind of where he really gets to. So the paragraph right in the middle of the the first paragraph on page 7, Bill goes to treatment, right? He's placed in a well-known hospital for mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics and addicts called treatment centers. The so-called belladonna treatment cleared my brain, right? So this is one of the methods in which therapy or treatment helped him. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise helped me much, right? So again, things that treatment were like, feeling good, getting my life back in order. Best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I had been seriously ill bodily and mentally. Okay, so he's learning about like triggers and how to avoid people, places and things and all that stuff. It's like, he's great. This is great. Then he goes on and says, it relieved me somewhat to learn that in an alcoholic, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor or crack or heroin or whatever else, though it often remains strong in other respects, right? So there's a lot of people in this room that were successful in other areas of their life, and so they're like, well, I should be able to beat this thing. I ran a business. I was an athlete. I did this. I did that. So I can handle this alcoholism and drug addiction. I just need to try harder. Pull yourself up from your bootstraps, right? All those things that we're told as men and women when we're kids of like how to be self-sufficient, right? My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer. Self-knowledge. Okay, so we've been hitting around it. We're going to go ahead and just smash it real quick. Triggers. Relapse prevention program. All these things, all these people, places, and things that you're supposed to stay away from. Halt. You know, hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Right? Be aware of hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Stay away from those things. New friend, what is it? New friend.
Playgrounds and playmates.
Change your
playground. Yeah, change your playgrounds and playmates. Right? The CA puts out this thing that's got a whole bunch of them.
Right? Oh God.
Go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Don't use between meetings. Don't drink no matter what.
Oh my God.
Throw away your drug paraphernalia. Throw away all your drugs. Avoid people, places, and things that associate with drug use. Don't deal drugs. Get phone numbers and use them. If no one is home and you're in trouble, call the hotline. Be of service. Get a commitment at a meeting. Go to coffee after meetings. Remember that you don't have to stay sober the rest of your life. We only do this one day at a time. Don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, tired. Halt. The connection. If the connection calls, hang up. If you think of using, think it all the way through. No matter what happens, keep coming back. Stick with the winners. Ask questions. Make sobriety number one priority. Be honest, open-minded, willingness. That one's actually good. Don't be too hard on yourself. Recovery takes time. We care. Love yourself. We'll love you until you can love yourself. So that's a lot of self-knowledge, right? That's a lot of things that I can do to stay clean and sober. Self-knowledge. We'll talk about it a little bit later on in the book where it says that no human power could have relieved my alcoholism or drug addiction. Well, if I know what my triggers are, guys, football games, lighting the grill, oxygen. Those were Brandon's triggers. Right? Those were the things that demanded, not asked, demanded. Mow the lawn and then do what? Drink a water? No, you drink a beer. That's what you do. It doesn't matter if it's 8 o'clock in the morning. That was another one of the things that I told myself. So this self-knowledge, it's great. It gives you a sort of awareness around it, but it doesn't fix alcoholism and drug addiction.
You know, I think one of the things that keeps people from committing to this process is this idea that you have to walk away from all the things you've enjoyed your whole life. So, you know, traveling around and seeing concerts was a big part of my life, you know. I got clean in 2007. I mean, I saw, somewhere between 250, 300 panic shows. And a frightening perspective was the fact that, man, I might not be able to go to Panic. And thank God for the two men that taught me this program. They're like, man, once you are in fit spiritual condition, you can go anywhere you want. And I've seen Panic, you know, well over 100 times in my recovery. I've been around friends that got high, passing around bags of Molly and cocaine and smoking pot all around me. I was married to a woman that partied hard. Now, granted, it was one of the contributing factors to our separation, among other things. I mean, she would dabble in cocaine from time to time. I mean, she would love smoking, you know, she would smoke pot. She had her vape pen. She was the director of HR at Sweetwater Brewery. I mean, I had liquor in my house 24/7, 365 days a year. Never once any desire to do any of that. So it did not. That just smashes every damn thing anyone ever told me at a treatment center because I'm in fit spiritual condition. That's the litmus test. I'm going to tell you guys a story. I was sitting at a Panic show on New Year's Eve 2013 or 14, and my buddy is in the program, and he's probably got about a year clean, been in and out. I've known him for years, traveled around the country, lived in hotel rooms with him. I remember we were at the show, and all the friends around us were passing bags of cocaine and Molly, and he turns to me during the show, and he goes, "Damn, man, that looks so good. Isn't there a part of you that wants to do that?" And I turned to him and I said, "Man, that's the difference between you and I, brother. It's invisible to me. I don't see it. I'm concerned about your recovery because you do see it." He wasn't in fit spiritual condition, and he didn't stick around much longer after that. He's back in now, but that's what it's truly about. I mean, what is this? Is it just freedom in certain situations, or is it, does freedom apply to all situations? You got to ask yourself these questions, man. Don't let anybody tell you you can't go back and do the things that you truly love doing. Hunting, going to football games.
My parents live on a lake, and my family goes out there on a regular basis, the whole family, and some of them probably potential alcoholics. They haven't admitted that they have a problem yet, but they when we're at the lake, they're getting hammered. So if I got to change my what is it again?
Playmates.
My playmates.
Your sponsor didn't spend much time on
No, that. He didn't. If I have to change my playmates and playgrounds, my kids don't get to experience the lake. They don't get to see their aunts and their uncles and their grandmother and their grandfather. They don't get to see their cousins. We don't get to go out there and enjoy that anymore. So, I mean, that would suck, right? What about, good God, what about Christmas? Like, we get together at Christmas, and I mean, it's like hammer time, right? Like, they are literally hammering. We open presents kind of before dinner so that everybody can kind of, like, fade away over the course of the evening, do whatever they want. Sorry, kids, we're canceling Christmas because the rest of the family drinks. Does that seem reasonable?
The key thing you said was you got to be. You wouldn't recommend someone going to a Panic concert a week out of a week.
No.
Out.
No. Yeah, that's key. Yeah. Fit spiritual condition, which I get as a result of working the steps.
I had 6 months before I ventured back out into that, and I had my road dog, my boy Dave. We were both in early recovery. We didn't do anything apart from each other. Like all those Panic shows I saw probably my first until I was about three or four years clean. I was pretty much always with him. You know, we'd get our own hotel room, and I mean, we definitely, you know, and then it just got to a point where I just didn't need that anymore. I felt safe and protected always, and I was always safe and protected, but I mean, yeah, I made wise decisions. I didn't, you know, I had a friend in recovery with me, sorry, I mean, I'm glad you said that so I could throw that in there, go ahead.
Bottom of the page, but it was not, for the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed. My weary and despairing wife was informed that she would have to end it with heart failure during delirium tremens, or I'd have to develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker. They did not need to tell me. I almost welcomed the idea. So here Bill is, right? Before, a couple pages back, he was, like, thinking all those people that wanted to kill themselves were weak, and then it was, well, maybe I'll do it. Then it's like, I'm not capable. Now it's like, please. Anybody get to that place? You don't have to raise your hand if you don't want. Anybody get to that place where you didn't care? I just don't want to live this way. I don't want to live because everything I've tried doesn't work. And page eight, first full paragraph. This really sounds like a surrender. No words can tell the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was now my drug of choice. Oh, wait. Alcohol was my master. Because that's what it was for me. I can't fight it. Can't fight it. I'm done. Alcohol says steal from my kid's piggy bank to go get more alcohol. Came on, let's do it. Alcohol said run up, max out every credit card you can, go on and party in the way that you really want to party. Let's do it. Oh, wait, I got caught. Do it again. I mean, that was my life. Because alcohol said do it.
You know, for me, I described that experience last night. One, when I was on that phone in the pod, and then in the courtroom with my mother, and I was split wide open. The voice of the liar completely went dormant and into remission, and I experienced loneliness like I'd never experienced it. I felt despair. I mean, crack cocaine had taken me to bankruptcy. I destroyed a decent relationship. I lost my home. I lost the respect of anyone that was close to me, and I felt like I was drowning in a swamp of self-pity, and quicksand stretched around me in all directions, and I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Crack cocaine was my master. It had completely stripped me of everything that I found meaningful and had any value in life. Gone. You know, it said, do this, and I did that. It said, you know, what my relationship with cocaine asked me to do was give up my means of livelihood, give up my job, give up my relationships, give up my self-respect, give up my self-dignity, give up walk away from my family. This is what cocaine asked me to do. And then you get to the 12 steps. And the 12 steps will ask you to do certain things. But here's the deal. It's fascinated me to watch this over the years is how literally what the 12 steps will ask you to do is like kissing a little baby on the cheek compared to what your master will ask you to do. And we don't make that connection. Right? We don't make that connection. And so that's another question you may want to look at, you know. Ask yourself, what did my relationship with my drug of no choice ask me to do? So, what did my drug of no choice, it could be alcohol, it could be any substance, that substance that puts you in the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, what did my relationship with my drug of no choice ask me to do? What did it ask me to give up? Because no person in their rational mind would make a choice to give up those things.
So then trembling, I stepped from the hospital a broken man. Fear sobered me a bit. So fear sobered me for 4 days after that brush with death, right? And that's it. So if you're staying sober off of fear, at some point, that fear will dissipate. And then what's keeping you sober? What's keeping you sober? We kind of scroll down, and it says, how dark it is before the dawn. Literally, the moment before the sun starts coming up is the absolute darkest part of the night. Like right just before the sun goes bloop, that is when the night is the darkest. And if you've ever been up and out during that time, like what you can see in stars and everything else, it is amazing. But then the sun comes up pretty darn fast, right? So that's where you've got to act, right? Is that moment when the sun just starts creeping up. And then it goes on to say, I was soon catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Oh, if you guys don't hear anything from us, hear this. We live in the fourth dimension, Tarek and I do. You can too. You actually kind of are, you just don't notice it. But that paragraph, I'm not sure I believed it when I first got here, but now I laugh at the possibility that I once thought that it couldn't exist.
You know, fourth dimension for me is seeing God and watching my father die from cancer. I could see God in that experience, because what I witnessed was this thing came to me, which was, you know, whatever humans think death is, it's not. So my purpose was to witness. So I sat by my father's bedside and I prayed and I read scripture and I played music for him and I whispered in his ear. And because of the fourth dimension, I said something, you know, my father, they didn't understand why he was holding on, you know. They called us, you know, my brother and I have been estranged for years. And the Wednesday, my father passed on a Saturday. On a Wednesday night, they had everyone come to the house. And I was doing some of the overnight shifts. And it was one of those things, when I showed up to see my dad, my brother would leave. And when my brother showed up, I would leave. That's how those first few days when he was transitioning were like. And on Wednesday night, they called us all over. There was like 2 or 3 in the morning. And I had my dad's hand. My brother had his other hand. And it was the last form of communication my dad made, which was he smiled. And I watched my brother just break down. And like all this ice between my brother and I just instantly melted away. And I watched him break down 2 more times over the next 48 hours. And up until that point, when I whispered in my dad's ear, I would whisper, Dad, you and I are complete. We have no unfinished business. It's okay for you to go. And that's one of the reasons that people will say, I'm so sorry for your loss. And yes, it was a loss, but you know, my dad and I were complete. Granted, I didn't have a relationship with my dad until I got clean and sober. First 31 years of my life, no relationship with my dad. I built it all in the last 10 years. And so on Saturday afternoon, I come over, and because of the fourth dimension of existence, Brandon and I, we try to pay attention to what the still small voice within says to us at times. And the one thing I'd refrained from whispering in my dad's ear was anything about my brother. And for whatever reason, that afternoon, my spirit spoke to me and said, whisper in your dad's ear that you're going to take care of your brother. And I whispered in my dad's ear that I was going to take care of my brother, and he took his last breath, and he was gone. It was like the relief was that's what he was waiting for. What if I had not been able to access my fourth dimension and really get that message clear, right? So that's what fourth dimension looks like for us. It's tapping the unsuspecting inner resource, but it's also seeing God in everything, not just joy and love and laughter. Yeah, God is there too, but God's in some really dark and not so comfortable and painful shit. Can we see God in everything? That, to me, is fourth dimension existence.
And the reason why it's so hard for most people to understand and access or even believe when we talk about it is because it requires a sixth sense, okay? And we're so grounded in the material, hard, touch, see, smell, hear, these things that keep us grounded in this dimension, the third dimension, what we're in, that we can't pay attention to that other stuff. Through meditation, through other spiritual practices, you start to gain access to this thing that you can't see, you can't hear. For me, I can't hear it. It's a conversation I have with myself and a feeling, okay? And depending on how your senses rep within your body, you're going to experience it in a different way. My wife sees it visually. What she experiences in the fourth dimension is a visual with a little bit of auditory. Mine's more of me kind of, it's me talking to me, but it's not me, okay? And it's a feeling coupled with an experience that I'm having internally that's kind of kinesthetic. And that's what this experience, but like even trying to explain it to you, it's like, I'm still not doing a very good job. Okay? So when somebody says, what does the fourth dimension look like? For me, it doesn't look like anything. Because it's an experience I have. It's something that I'm in the middle of getting kind of all this craziness going on inside me. Okay? So if you're looking for something specific, good luck. You're going to keep looking because it's going to show up differently than you think it's going to show up. And then as you go on and you start to test this thing, and you test and you experience and you test and you experience and you test, you start to gain a little trust, you start to gain a little faith with whatever this is. And at that point in time, then you're hooked up. I can't get that in a book, guys. There's no scripture that tells me how to do that. The scripture is pointing me to that. If I read through the scripture and all the spiritual books of the past, they tell me what the experience is like, but it's a bunch of words. And because I see it as words, I can't worship the words because that's not the experience. Mm. That's what's so crazy about this stuff, guys. Is it's like, enjoy the ride. That's where you get the experience from. So then, in this back part of the Bill story, it's talking about Ebby Thatcher coming to visit him. Ebby was Bill's drinking buddy, right? So Ebby was that guy that when he showed up and was sober, there was no identification necessary for Bill because it was like Ebby was one of those guys that Bill was like, if I ever get as bad as that guy, then I'll quit, right? He was that measuring stick. He was that guy that's like, well, I don't really have a problem because he has a problem. And so, but he shows up at Bill's house and Bill offers him a drink and he's like, nope, I found religion, Bill. And Bill's like, what the hell are you talking about? That's not possible. And then they go through this experience of multiple days back and forth where Ebby's trying to challenge Bill to consider that maybe there's a God. And then they've got this wonderful little paragraph. It's real short. It says, my friend suggested what then seemed like a novel idea. Say, Bill, why don't you choose your own conception of God? Because I'm sure that's exactly how that question was posed. After multiple days or weeks of arguing back and forth about there is God, there is no God, I'm sure that Ebby just got to the point where he's like, you know what, Bill? Why don't you go fuck yourself? I'm tired of arguing with you. If you don't think God exists, I don't care. But maybe consider that, like, God's going to be different for you than it is for me, so why don't you figure out your own goddamn God, right? And then all of a sudden Bill goes, huh, wait a minute. So I don't have to believe this, 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 and this. I can believe this and experience this. Huh. Because I think that's what really happened in that meeting. I don't think it was this real formal and, you know, proper, say, Bill, why don't you choose your own conception of God?
You guys got to remember that the Oxford group was, you know, they were called the first century Christianity before they were even called the Oxford group. So I'm willing to bet at some point in this conversation, you know, they work out of the King James Bible. A lot of the book comes from Corinthians. And so there was a lot of talk of Jesus Christ. There's no doubt about it. So the divinity of this conversation, how it truly went down, was, I think, some frustration on Ebby's part, just like Brandon described. And he's like, man, just make up your own God. And the minute you give someone like that, how can you argue? You can't. There's no room to argue anymore. But what I watch guys struggle with is they get into recovery, they grew up with a certain set of beliefs, and now they're trying to put everything they're learning into recovery into this box around their beliefs, and anything outside the box creates resistance.
Their dogma.
Yeah. And so what I do with guys I sponsor is we need to strip the box. We don't ever want a box, but people go back into the box. I have my box from time to time, and then I realize I'm in a box, and the box falls away.
And not like a refrigerator box.
No, not a refrigerator box. And so figuring God out is not even something that we attempt to do. I know the longer I stay clean and sober, the less and less I understand about God. The less and less definitions I use for God, nor do I comprehend the power. I just don't. It keeps it very fluid and in motion for me. And then it's also a source of freedom for me because it allows me to read books from every tradition.
And I love the guys that claim that they're an atheist. And I'm like, and I talk to them. I'm like, okay, no. You're not an atheist. You just, your God's not Christian, right? But there's other stuff out there. And now we live in a country that makes it very difficult for us to have a different conception of God than some sort of Christian God, because that's what our laws are based on. That's what, you know, our society's based on. They say it's not separation of church and state. But guys, look at the history of how this country came about. I mean, this country was established on, I'm not going to believe in your way of Christianity, but I'm going to believe my way, and I want to go experience that in a different place. So it's hard for us to get to completely escape it in our culture because it's so ingrained in it. But the one question I always like to ask a guy that claims that he was an atheist and that will argue with me that he is absolutely, there is no God, is, have you ever been wrong about anything in your life? Is it possible that you're wrong about this? Especially if this is the only way that you're going to get and stay sober, is it worth considering, or are you just not willing to? And I go to a lot of meetings, and they don't want to talk about God, even though it's all in the steps and it's on the wall and everything else. They don't want to talk about God because they don't want to offend anybody. But our buddy Chris from Texas, he says it better than anybody else. We're going to talk about God. If you don't like it, you can go out there, try a different way, and when you come back, we're going to be talking about God. That's it. Now, when I say God, maybe change it to spirit or Mother Nature or whatever else it is that you want to call it, and maybe you can be more open to it. But God's three letters is a lot easier to say than like go into what I really believe it is every time I say whatever it is that I believe it is. So we'll go with God for now. Mm. You take it through the... Mm-hmm. Once you hit the rest of that.
Okay. Page 12. Fourth full paragraph. After he, you know, makes the statement to Bill about creating his own conception, Bill says, it was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. Thus was I convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want him enough. At long last, I saw, I felt, I believed. Scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes. A new world came into view. when you're working with guys and they've really been crushed by that self-imposed crisis, they can't postpone or evade, and they've experienced a surrender and they're completely open-minded and they're following all your directions, God, it's such a beautiful thing to work with guys that are just crushed. They just want the next set of directions. It's so beautiful. And then it's so pathetic and frustrating to watch those other guys that just will not follow suggestions, will not follow directions. And you just, your heart bleeds for them. And at the same time, I struggle sometimes because I lack empathy and I lack sympathy. And that it's been one of my grosser handicaps, to be honest with you.
I want you to call me every day. And they call you every third day. And you're like, okay, so when I said I want you to call me every day, what did you think I meant? Well, you know, I didn't want to bother you. Okay. Well, did I say I don't want you to bother me, so don't call me every day? It is amazing to me how the simplest instructions can get really twisted with alcoholics and addicts. Like, the simplest instructions. I want you to show up at this meeting and this meeting because I want you to get in touch with this network of guys. Well, you know, I was going to be late, so I went to this other one. Okay, because that's what I said. I want you to be at this meeting or this meeting, but if you're going to be late, don't come. Go somewhere else. That's what I said, right? No, that's not what I said. But that those guys are so hard as a sponsor to work with versus the guy that's like, okay, I'll go to those. Are there any other ones that you would suggest? This guy came down from Pennsylvania, met him on Wednesday. I've been corresponding with him since Wednesday. Like, he's like, hey, man, that meeting was awesome. Do you have another one that I could go to? Okay, well, I recommend this one. Great. Is it at this church? You know, like, we're engaged. This guy's 4 years sober. He knows what it looks like to be hungry to find a group of people that he can hook up with versus this new guy that has never had any sustained sobriety at all, wants to go work his plan. It's like, I don't, like, where's the malfunction here, guys? And am I talking about you or am I not talking about you? I don't know. Check your experience. Are you capable of following simple directions or not? If you're not, you're probably not going to make it, period.
So, the foundation of complete willingness is built on the notion that you see death in your first step, in my opinion. If you see a life and death dilemma in your first step, then you're going to be willing to believe in the second step, and you're not going to argue and you're not going to debate. That's the simplest way I can put it. I saw death in my first step. My first step says I'm going to drink and I'm going to get high. So as a result, as one of my sponsors says, I run over my sponsor like a Mack truck to get to step two. I don't have any debate. And so Bill, in the next page, he runs through these steps. And I'm not going to run through them for time's sake, but, I mean, he gives a wonderful description. What I invite you to do, ask yourself, have I humbly offered myself to my Creator? Have I placed myself unreservedly under the care and direction of a power greater than myself? I know I'm going to struggle with that, but is that my intent? Do I see that without God in my life, I am nothing and I am lost? Am I willing to ruthlessly face my sins and become willing to have my new friend, found friend, God, take them away root and branch, not just the consequences of my defects, but actual defects? Am I willing to humbly say to God, I am broken, and will you fix this part of me because I cannot fix me? Am I willing to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability? Am I willing to test my new thinking by this new found God consciousness within? My friend promised when these things were done, then I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator. Well, it's simple but not easy. A price has to be paid. It's the destruction of self-centeredness. I want to do this. I want to do that. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do that. I must have access to a telephone. I will not submit to a way other than my own. I will manipulate every single thing I can to get my way.
I need to talk to my wife. I need to talk to my kids. I need to talk to this person. I need to talk to that person.
We watch.
Is that a way other than your own? Or is that your own just showing up in a little different way?
And self-centeredness means I think about Tarek way too often. That's all that means. And the only way to move away from that is to begin to live a life that focuses on what can I bring to this person's life instead of what can I always suck out of this room, right? So, I must turn in all things to the Father of light who presides over us all. This is my favorite paragraph. Who in here has actually worked the steps? Who's gone through the steps with a sponsor? Who is beginning to have an experience with sponsorship and so forth? Here's a checklist for you. So the proposals your sponsor submitted to you were revolutionary and drastic. Have you fully accepted them? Have you felt electricity run through your life? Have you experienced a sense of victory? Have you experienced peace and serenity on a level you've never known before? Have you felt utter confidence? Have you felt lifted up? Have you felt a clean wind blow through your life? God comes to most men gradually. He came to Bill all of a sudden. Like all the things I described happened to Bill all at once. What I'm asking you to see is if you've had these on a piecemeal basis, have you experienced these things? Because if you haven't, we need to sit down and have a discussion if you've worked the steps. Because I've experienced every single one of those things in my recovery. Now, they didn't hit me all at once, but I've experienced them. So we're going to go down to page, the bottom of page 14, and we're going to break. This is one of the most important sentences in the big book. It's a couple of sentences. Faith without works is dead. How appallingly true for the addict and alcoholic. For if Tarek and Brandon fail to perfect and enlarge their spiritual lives through work and self-sacrifice for others. So now you're sitting to yourself, you're wondering about the checklist I just rattled off. And you're like, well, that hasn't happened. That hasn't happened. Now the question is this. Are you growing spiritually through work and self-sacrifice for others? What are you doing in terms of working and sacrificing your personal time for others? Or do you only work and sacrifice your time for yourself? Because if you don't work and sacrifice your time for others, you will not survive the trials and low spots which are coming for you. If you do not work, then you're surely going to get drunk or get high. And if guys like Tarek and Brandon drink and get high, we die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. And then one more thing I want to point out is on page 16. Second to last paragraph, the last sentence. It says, faith has to work 24 hours a day in and through us or we perish. You know the big book references 24 hours two times, and neither time does it have anything to do with not drinking and not using. It references faith, and then in step 11 it says we got to think about the 24 hours ahead. Where did we get this idea that we stay clean and sober one day at a time? Where I personally think it came from is that James Gardner and James Woods movie that came out, and like I don't know what year it came out in, but at the very end of the movie it's got James Woods and James Gardner walking down the road, and they're like all the jingles are, it's like the guy that shared at the meeting the other night, the jingles are just flowing from James Garner, and he's just like, Bill, we have to keep it simple. We just don't drink no matter what, one day at a time. And maybe the treatment centers grabbed a hold of that, because I know I was forced to watch that movie in treatment. And maybe that's where it came from, but it's not in our big book. And if it cannot be reconciled with the big book, I disregard it. In early recovery. Now, there are things in this book that I have questioned over the years, and I will continue to question them, and I don't believe every sentence in the book to be true. I used to be a guy that said that. You can't believe some of the book and not all the book. Not true, because I've done my own investigations, and my experience just doesn't line up with it. But for the majority of this book, I do wholeheartedly believe. It's a very powerful, profound account of spirituality. I'm going to take a break after I read this prayer. My Lord God, I have no idea where I'm going, or we have no idea where we're going. We don't see the road ahead of us. We cannot know for certain where it's going to end, nor do we really know ourselves. And the fact that we think that we're following your will does not mean that we're actually doing so. But we believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you. And we hope we have that desire in all that we are doing. We hope that we will never do anything apart from that desire. And we know that if we do this, you will lead us by the right road, though we may know nothing about it. Therefore, will we trust you always, though we may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death. We will not fear, for you are ever with us, and you will never leave us to face our perils alone. Thomas Merton. All right, guys, we're gonna break for 20 minutes, and we're gonna snack through the lunchtime. Then we're ordering dinner in at 5 o'clock. So there's gonna be a ton of pizza and stuff. So you guys bear with us. Buckle up.